Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Elliot Carlson against the United States. Ms. Lilly? May it please the court, Jamie Lilly for the United States. The issue before the court in this appeal is whether a district court pursuant to its inherent authority may deviate from the clear text of a rule promulgated by the Supreme Court and Congress. In this case, petitioners argue that the text of the rule can't mean what it says. The rule provides that unless the rules provide otherwise, matters occurring before the grand jury may not be disclosed.
So can you give me an example where a qualification buried in a subpart of a subpart is actually pulled out of that subpart of a subpart and put into some chapeau for the whole rule? You are looking at E to capital B. So 6E to capital B.
Yes, Your
Honor.
Which
is where, unless these rules provide otherwise.
Yes,
and that
Your Honor.
Addresses who may disclose a matter apart from a court order. A grand juror, an interpreter, a court reporter, all of these people are not supposed to do it. The list is seven long. And you want us to take 6E to capital B and export that to subpart capital E. Now, when, just as a matter of rule and statutory interpretation, can you give me another example where that kind of maneuver has been done?
Your Honor, the provision that we discuss is described in the legislative history and by courts as the general rule of non-disclosure.
Well, that's not helpful, though, because the rule... I mean, we read the text of the the rule, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And it's not there. Indeed, capital E uses the much milder word may authorize disclosure.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it doesn't say except as otherwise provided. It doesn't say anything. It just says may.
Yes, Your Honor. And as this court has recognized, the general rule of non-disclosure applies to all in privity with the information, save witnesses. And then the rule...
But it's not talking about the court's supervisory authority over the grand jury.
No, Your Honor, because the court wouldn't have access to the information. The court would have to authorize someone in privity with that information listed in E2B. To disclose that information, which is the explanation for the deviation in the language that you're talking about. A court could not authorize disclosure of information, the court could not disclose information that it doesn't have. It must authorize one of those parties listed in E2B to disclose the information.
Can I ask you a random question? Does the government keep every single set of transcripts before every grand jury that has ever been convened off there in Suitland, Maryland, or wherever they are?
No, Your Honor.
Is there a destruction policy?
There are various schedules. There are internal storage policies and archival policies, and then there are schedules negotiated between different agencies with the archives for the transfer of files there.
But when you say schedules, are you using that as a euphemism for destruction?
No, Your Honor. In those cases, those would be terms and conditions governing the transfer and storage of those files.
So you're telling me others, that they are all stored?
No, Your Honor. They are not all stored. Some would not go into the permanent records of the archives and may, in fact, be destroyed after certain periods of time or in other circumstances.
Now, no other court of appeals has agreed with you. You're asking us to create a conflict in the circuits, aren't you?
We are asking you to disagree with the language in the Second Circuit opinion that would recognize the possibility of this sort of disclosure. Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, it's not just the Second Circuit. The 11th Circuit came to much the same outcome, and other circuits have indicated that they would do the same thing. I don't know that you have anybody on your side yet.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has said that in cases that postdate many of the Court of Appeals cases that you're talking about, that a district court has no inherent authority to deviate from the clear language of
the
rule.
Of course, yeah. And so the question, yeah, absolutely. And so in the Supreme Court decisions, such as Carlisle, for example, there was an express command, Bank of Nova Scotia, there was an express provision in the rules. That sort of rephrases our question, doesn't it? Is there any kind of deviation that would be necessary, or is this a matter simply not addressed?
Yes, Your Honor, but in Carlisle, the court made clear that whether the command at issue was an exclusive, a direct prohibition on the court's exercise of discretion there, the court sought to consider an untimely motion for acquittal, and the rule provided for an express time limit.
The rule expressly forbade untimely motions for acquittal.
Yes,
so
Your
naturally.
Honor. And the court said...
Go ahead. Yeah.
And the court said, whether we consider this as an untimely motion in violation of the express text of the rule or some sort of sua sponte exercise of authority to hear a motion for acquittal, the principle is the same, that the court may not deviate or contradict or contravene the text of the rules. In that case, there was no express rule prohibiting a sua sponte motion for acquittal, but the court said that that would contradict and contravene and undermine the Supreme Court and Congress's authority to promulgate the federal rules in that case.
Right. It's my understanding of your argument is that Rule 6 displaced the court's common law, limited common law supervisory authority over the institution of the grand jury, and covers the field essentially.
Yes, Your Honor. When Congress and the Supreme Court use language like they have in E2B, they've set up a highly reticulated set of exceptions that make clear when it is permissible for a court to order disclosure.
No residual common law supervisory authority, limited or otherwise, over the grand jury. It's all channeled into the rule.
Certainly none on the order or scale of magnitude that we have proposed here, Your Honor, no.
Well, generally, if the federal rules are silent, does the court have the inherent authority to make provisions for something that's not specifically prohibited or authorized?
Your Honor, in the case we have here before us, where we're talking about deviations from the centuries-long tradition of grand jury secrecy, there is no authority to deviate from the express text of the rules to permit...
Well, that didn't answer my question about the federal rules generally.
I apologize.
So what about Rule 57B, which your opponents have cited?
Yes, Your Honor, is this the rule providing for some authority to make procedural rules that do not conflict with the federal rules?
Well, procedure when there is no controlling law. So it may be of some relevance to the question Judge Kaney asked.
We had cases not too long ago which indicated the district courts do carry inherent authority to do exactly that. If it's not prohibited or authorized, they can fashion something that wasn't addressed either way.
Your Honor, to the extent that there is any sort of authority, residual authority to adopt certain procedural rules, that would certainly not cover petitioner's claim here. What they're seeking is inherent authority that would recognize the ability of a district court to order disclosure of grand jury secrets simply on the request made by a third party unconnected to any district court proceeding.
Ms. Lilly, I would think that your answer would be that Rule 57 covers the court's authority to promulgate rules where there are none for its own proceedings. And
yes,
this is not its own proceeding. The grand jury is an independent, freestanding body, and the court has very limited supervisory authority over it. It's
yes,
basically,
yes,
the court's authority is constitutive only. It calls the grand jury into being by summoning jurors, and it swears the jurors, and that's about it.
Yes, Your Honor.
The only other authority is found in the rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the antecedent question.
Yes, Your Honor, that any residual authority recognized in Rule 57 would not apply here. Simply put, the district court's exercise of supervisory power over the grand jury is limited in nature and certainly would not extend to the type of extraordinary breach of grand jury secrecy that petitioners propose here.
Now, of course, interestingly, the Advisory Committee on Criminal Rules doesn't agree with you on this point, whether we choose to give any weight to their views or not being separate question. And I wouldn't describe the Second Circuit's approach in Craig as kind of a willy-nilly disclosure approach. There are very many safeguards that the Craig court suggested would need to be erected around any disclosure outside the boundaries. And as well, there's the history of 6E, which seems to be, you know, a matter of codification of commonly occurring reasons to disclose that are authorized to the court. It hasn't gone the other way around.
Oh. Yes, Your Honor, if I may take those points in turn.
Sure.
The Criminal Rules Advisory Committee did not adopt the Justice Department's proposal to amend the rules.
And because they thought it was unnecessary.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has cautioned the use of unenacted amendments to infer any sort of
No, but you wanted to use legislative history a while ago. I'm just saying they said they thought it was unnecessary. So I'm not a big fan of unenacted amendments either, but if the committee says we understand the rule to make this unnecessary, it's a datum. You know.
But the rule stands unamended, Your Honor, and that's why we're here, because the rule does not provide for the type of disclosure that petitioners seek.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, as written, capital E does not list this area.
Yes, Your Honor.
I need a clarification about the jurisdictional basis for this suit,
yes,
as well as the plaintiff's standing to bring it.
Yes, sir.
They're not invoking the rule, so we don't have 1331 in play. And I don't see an alternative jurisdictional basis for the suit, and I'm not sure what the plaintiff's standing is.
Well, Your Honor, the rules provide for or contemplate that someone seeking disclosure of the materials.
But they're not invoking the rule. They're not invoking Rule 6E.
That they're invoking the district court's inherent authority to.
Well, right. Under what jurisdictional grant can a citizen come into court and ask the court to use its inherent authority to do something? I mean, that's extraordinarily broad and vague. I don't understand it.
Yes, Your Honor, and perhaps petitioners can speak to that.
You know, we have to address jurisdiction.
Yes.
Can you think of some other jurisdictional basis? You didn't object to jurisdiction here.
No, Your Honor. And
nor did you challenge standing, but we do have to address it.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And in our brief before the court, we noted that that the district court was essentially deciding a question about the rule, and on that basis.
No, I don't think you did. I think the jurisdictional statements of the parties had to do with inherent power. And if the court's inherent power were alone enough, I mean, it's circular, essentially. It would permit anybody to come into court and ask for the court to use its inherent power to grant some form of relief.
Yes, Your Honor.
No one is asking for a construction of the rule here, an interpretation, application, construction of the rule. What's being requested is an invocation or a use, application of the court's inherent power, and that strikes me as at bottom, a jurisdictional question.
Yes, Your Honor, if the court would like the government to address
that. Might be a good idea. I mean, there's also a question about standing. I don't know what injury the plaintiffs are complaining about.
All right, so we'll have both parties file within 14 days of today's argument simultaneous memoranda addressing the issues that Judge Sykes has identified, both the jurisdictional basis for this petition and standing.
Yes, Your
Honor. So you may save the rest of your time for rebuttal if
you'd
like. Ms. Townsend.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Katie Townsend. I'm counsel for appellees. The only issue raised by the government in this appeal is a narrow one. Does a district court have any authority to direct disclosure of grand jury material in any circumstances other than those expressly set forth in Rule 6E3E, the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure?
So wouldn't you agree that 6E3E is phrased in permissive terms? It tells when the court is entitled to authorize a disclosure.
That's right, Your Honor. We do agree with that.
You don't have to authorize disclosure in all of these instances. There's still discretion that the court's going to exercise.
That's absolutely correct. That's the Supreme Court's decision in Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. You don't get automatic disclosure.
Exactly. So why isn't it the case that you're asking, you know, for a subpart 6 to be added to the rule that's never been there? I mean, why does it doesn't even say, that the court may authorize disclosure in the following situations and in addition in others when strong arguments can be made for it or something, you know, when the court regards it as a well-founded request. So there's no like little savings clause in there, is there?
Well, there need not be. In this case, we're dealing with a situation where the supervisory authority that we're stating that the district court had existed pre-rule. It's a pre-existing inherent authority.
Why
it's
wasn't
not,
it displaced by the rule?
The Supreme Court has held in Chambers and in Link v. Wabash Railroad Company that permissive rules do not displace inherent authority and even pre-existing inherent authority.
This isn't a permissive rule. This is a rule that channels whatever pre-existing limited supervisory authority the court had over the grand jury into a concrete rule with limitations.
It doesn't place
express limitations.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think it does not place express limitations on the court. I think,
It codifies the rule of secrecy. The Supreme Court has said that, the longstanding common law rule of secrecy.
That is correct.
And it creates some exceptions to that, and you don't qualify under any of them, and so you're not invoking the rule. You're seeking an exercise of inherent power that doesn't exist.
I think the supervisory power does in fact exist.
Well, it exists pursuant to the limits of the rule because the rule codified the pre-existing common law inherent authority of the court, limited though it was.
The inherent authority that courts, supervisory authority that courts have or grand jury proceedings are, I think undoubtedly under Williams, it is more limited than it is, say, with respect to the court's proceedings in civil proceedings pending before it. That does not mean the supervisory authority doesn't exist, and I think
so you
the
need
government's
to give us
position,
examples. I mean, the proposition that Judge Sykes has put on the table mm-hmm. is that once Rule 6 exists, it has wiped out whatever else may have been there in the background. And you need to give examples, if you can, of Supreme Court decisions, preferably, or other decisions where it suggests that that's not the way Rule 6 should be understood.
The Supreme Court's never addressed this precise question with respect to Rule 6. It has addressed a similar question in Link v. Wabash Railroad Company when it concluded that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 41B did not displace pre-existing, pre-rule inherent authority possessed by the district court.
Right, but that rule has to do with the court's authority over its own proceedings. This is not a court proceeding. It is fundamentally different.
And I understand that the distinction that was drawn in the Williams case between the scope of a court's supervisory authority with respect to grand jury proceedings. I think what Williams suggests is that that supervisory authority needs to be tied to one of the traditional functions that is played by the district court with respect to the grand jury. So calling the grand jury, compelling evidence to be presented to the
grand
jury,
and
compelling witnesses.
Your request has nothing to do with any of that.
But it does touch upon an area that was prior to enactment of the rule, an area where the district court had supervisory authority.
Right, and theretofore,
secrecy.
Before the enactment of the rule and since, the exercise of that supervisory authority has only been undertaken in the context of a proceeding then ongoing in the court. This is completely outside of that.
And I would say that that's not the case, because that certainly in N. Ray Biagi, Second Circuit, and Judge Friendly's opinion ordered the disclosure of contemporary grand jury material, in part because of the public interest. That was the case in Hastings. That was the case in Craig, which we argue is the best sort of statement of the law on this issue and the template that the district court below followed. So we're not advocating for anything that Congress and, frankly, the rules drafters didn't want to happen. When they enacted the rule, it was drafted in 1944 and promulgated in 1946. They made clear that it was continuing the traditional practice that existed prior to the rule's enactment to allow district courts to have discretion to order disclosure of grand jury material in appropriate circumstances. Rule 6E may not, and wisely may not, choose to cover all individual instances or all individual circumstances
that
may arise.
What work is the rule doing then, if the court has residual discretionary power to do whatever it wants, whenever it wants?
And I would say that I don't think that the court has residual authority to
that's
do
what you're arguing
whatever,
that's the
whenever.
That's the basic argument for power here that you're making. And then you're suggesting that, you know, there needs to be some policy parameters placed on that power. But the authority that you're arguing for here is essentially unlimited.
And I don't think it
and
is
so
unlimited.
And so the rule is doing no work.
And I would disagree that the rule is doing no work. I think what the rule does is codify exceptions that were developed over time that were needed more broadly.
Yes, and when that's done, that displaces the old authority and becomes the font or source of the court's power. Nothing is left.
And I think that that's belied by both the purpose of the rule and the language of the rule, which does not indicate that that's the case. And I think it's also belied by the history of the rule, which has continued to develop
so
past
under
the 1977
rule,
amendment.
Surely you would agree that insofar as the rule addresses things, Carlisle would prohibit the district court from deviating from the provisions of the rule. And in that instance, the rule is doing some work. I would also note that throughout the rule, not just the area that has been called to our attention, the rule is referring constantly back to the court's authority. So, for example, on recording, E1, there's a rule about recording, but it's unless the court orders otherwise, an attorney for the government will retain control of the recording. So the court's in there governing what the grand jury is actually doing as it proceeds.
With respect to Carlisle, I will say that the majority opinion did not reject the notion that permissive rules cannot displace pre-existing inherent power. In fact, Justice Scalia in his majority opinion recognized that, which is what the dissent argued. What he said was, well, here we're dealing with a rule that isn't about pre-existing inherent authority. We're not dealing with a rule that carries forward pre-existing inherent authority. So he found that doctrine inapplicable. I would
and
say
so,
it's very
so
applicable here.
Let's just
here.
Start with A1. The rule says the grand jury has to have 16 to 23 members, and so I presume that you would agree that the court, in the exercise of its inherent authority, can't convene a 26-member grand jury.
Yes, the rules and Congress can place limitations on the exercise of courts inherent authority.
So the question is whether there are such limitations here.
That's correct.
In subpart capital E, when it makes a very clear list of what certain areas where the court is entitled to authorize disclosure.
It does include five examples or five specific situations where the rulemakers determined that it would be wise to have uniformity of practice with respect to these exceptions.
There? What work is the rule doing there if the list isn't really five long and it doesn't say inter alia or anything like that?
I think there are practical benefits. One, the court doesn't have to determine with respect to each of these exceptions. It applies the Douglas Oil standard. Is there a particularized need for disclosure under Rule 6E3E under those exceptions? I think it applies a higher standard. It places a higher burden, at least the district court did on us. And I think that the court in Craig indicates that the burden is much higher for exceptions that fall outside the scope of Rule 6E. So I think that there's sort of that practical work in the sense that these are exceptions that are not individualized in the sense that it isn't an individual, unique set of special circumstances that brings a party to the court to request disclosure. These are very commonplace, frequently used exceptions that the rules makers have made clear are appropriate exercises of district court's discretion to order disclosure.
I guess I worry about how it's constrained because, you know, I'm thinking of some of the recent events, perhaps the New York State Court proceedings relating to the transcript of the grand jury that looked into Eric Garner's death. Now, a court might decide that that's a matter of tremendous public interest and those transcripts should be released, whereas the prosecutors might have very strong reasons for thinking that secrecy is still, I mean, suppose it had been, you know, to bring it under Rule 6E, suppose it had been a U.S. Attorney's Office investigation, not a state court. It's not hard to think of instances like that. This one, in our case, happens to be 1942, which does sound like, you know, an eternity ago, but you aren't relying on anything like that.
Well, I think that the Second Circuit said in Craig, to conclude as a matter of law that sort of one factor is determinative is not consistent with the nature of the necessary flexibility that a district court has to have in order to confront what are unique circumstances. And I think there are limiting principles. Certainly every court to address this has made clear it only applies when the circumstances are unique, when they're special, when they're extraordinary, whatever the language is that the court wants to use. And in addition, they have made it clear that it can only be exercised following a fact-intensive, nuanced evaluation of the need for ongoing secrecy.
So you would imagine that's subject to abuse of discretion review?
It absolutely would be subject to abuse of discretion review. I think Craig is a good example because in Craig, while the Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit made clear that it would not have that there are circumstances where, for example, historical interest alone might satisfy the standard. The district court in Craig denied access. It said these circumstances aren't extraordinary enough, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that as not an abuse of the district court's discretion.
Well, we will certainly look forward to your statements about jurisdiction and standing. Judge Sykes is concerned that sort of anybody wandering down the street can pop in and ask for grand jury documents to be released, and then instead of just saying you're not part of the list, which would be a very easy way to deal with that, according to you, the district court is going to have to spend some serious time.
And with that, I would just say, Your Honor, that the notion that a decision by this court recognizing that there is residual supervisory authority to disclose grand jury materials in special circumstances, as the court did in Craig, is not going to open the floodgates or destroy the foundations upon which the grand jury is founded. In fact, in the almost 20 years since the Craig decision was decided by the Second Circuit in 1997, there have only been six, including our own, petitions for access to archival grand jury material of the kind that's at issue in this petition. And that includes two petitions that sought access to basically material at two different points in time, in 2008 and 2015, from one grand jury proceeding involving an investigation of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. So this is not a situation where petitioners are flocking to the courts to ask for grand jury material to be unsealed, nor is it a situation where I think district courts would tolerate that. I think the district court's decision in this case makes abundantly clear that it is only upon unique circumstances, only upon the application of factors like the Craig factors, which take into account the need for ongoing grand jury secrecy, that such a disclosure would be warranted.
An argument that we shouldn't worry about floodgates isn't grounded in jurisdictional principles. So what is your injury? I mean, that's the jurisdictional question for standing, right? Well, first of all, what's the jurisdictional grant that you're invoking here, since you're not invoking the rule? And then secondarily, what is your client's injury?
And on that point, I would note that the provision in the rule, which states that the petitions to unseal should be submitted to the district court that supervises.
That's a procedural provision, because the district court is not in custody of the documents. The district court is not the records custodian, as it would be for purposes of a request to unseal its own records. The government is in possession of these records. So I'm talking about a jurisdictional grant.
I understand, and I would say that the court in Douglas Oil, prior to enactment of that, made clear that
there was an ongoing criminal proceeding in that case, was there not?
There were two separate proceedings, and disclosure was being sought.
So there was no question about jurisdiction.
Well, I think the question was, which court should this party seeking disclosure go to? And in the majority opinion, Justice Powell said, well, of course you have to go to the court that controls the record, the guardian of those grand jury transcripts.
Right, but there was no question of jurisdiction in that case. Here there is a question of jurisdiction, because this is a new suit. There were ongoing cases there.
I don't think the simple fact that there is a disclosure is being sought for one of the reasons in Rule 6E, or one of the exceptions in Rule 6E, changes the jurisdictional grant of the supervising court that controls access, whether they have custody of the records or not. They certainly control the access.
That's only pursuant to the rule. You're not invoking the rule.
And prior to that portion of the rule, in Douglas Oil, which predated that section of the rule, the court concluded.
Right, but we have the rule now, so you have to give me a source of a jurisdictional grant, and then you have to explain what your client's injury is.
I understand, Your Honor. I think we've taken the position that, and I think as we stated in our jurisdictional statement, that the jurisdiction is appropriate. As the Craig Court found, jurisdiction is appropriate, certainly completely outside the bounds of the rule. Jurisdiction is appropriate in the supervising court to entertain a request to unseal grand jury records,
pursuant,
which, even if you consider them not judicial records and they are records only of a separate body.
But they're records only under the control of the district court. They're not under the control of whoever it is who runs the building where they're lodged.
That is correct. Whether or not they're in the possession of the government's attorneys or NARA or someone else does not change the fact that they are in the control of, and secrecy is controlled by, the district court.
So what's the jurisdictional grant?
I argue that the court and I think
you argued 1331, and you've done so, I thought, because it's their First Amendment issues in your case, and there are other issues as well beyond Rule 6E. But rather than doing this on the fly, these are difficult questions, and I would really urge both parties to think about.
We will
their
submit
responses.
A Rule 28J.
And as you think about that, you might want to look at the case of Bond versus Utreus.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which speaks directly to this question, and no one cited.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Lilly?
Yes, Your Honor. Just one point briefly. The court has asked questions about what would cabin this sort of untethered discretion, and I think petitioners have pointed to no examples. The Craig Court, in the test that it offered and made up, said even those were sort of non-exhaustive.
So would you make the same argument about other areas where the Supreme Court has said inherent authority exists but should be used sparingly, such as in the Chambers case? Your argument really says there should never be inherent authority of the court when there are rules in the neighborhood that govern these things, and the Supreme Court has actually not said that.
Your Honor, we have said in our brief, and I want to be clear, that any sort of inherent authority is the sort of authority that the Supreme Court has recognized to manage its own docket.
Well,
about to conduct affairs before the court.
That's not the argument you were just making, though. You were just saying if there's inherent authority, then where does it stop in the Supreme Court, especially if there are rules such as Rule 11, such as 1927, such as other things, Rule 37. The argument you're making would have said there's no inherent authority in that field either.
Your Honor, let me be clear. I was responding to the court's question of what might cabin this exercise of authority, and the answer is the rule should cabin the exercise of any authority to permit disclosure. The okay. rules have done so in a set of detailed examples, and an amendment to the rule would properly cabin the district court.
I think we have your point. Thank you very much. We will await your submissions, and subject to that, the case will be taken under advisement.